Thank you. David, would you like a quick roll call?
Yeah, please.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's STI URS call, we have Wendy Seltzer, David Maher, Alan Greenberg, Mark Partridge, Zahid Jamil, Konstantinos Komaitis, Kathy Kleinman, Robin Gross, Mai Diop, who is unfortunately on mute because she's calling in from Egypt, so she will not be able to actively participate on the call because this line is creating a huge echo. From staff, we have Liz Gaster, Amy Statos, Margie Milam, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and we have Jeff Newman, who will be joining us 30 minutes late. And if you could please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you.
This is David. We have posted the URS straw man proposal dated November 9. Although this is, I think, a later version, isn't it? Does anyone know?
This is Margie. It's the version that John Nevitt had sent out on the, I think it was the 11th.
Oh, okay, thanks. Unless anyone thinks otherwise, I think we should start, just go through this list. The first issue is whether or not the URS is mandatory for all new GTLDs, whereas ICANN has said it should be a best practice. Does anyone want to comment on this? Or do we have consensus on it being...
David, this is Kathy.
Yeah.
Sorry, I haven't gotten around to raising my hand officially. There we go. We're definitely moving in the direction of fairness and due process, and given that that was the goal, and assuming that goal is achieved, fairness, due process, appropriate appeals, NCSG will go with mandatory.
Okay, thank you. That's good progress. elements of the complaint, the same as in the UDRP text. Again, any comments on that? Kathy?
Yeah, I just sent out a notice. Sorry to send it out so late. Konstantinos, although he is on the call with us, has the flu. We have taken to heart the STI's request to go and look at the elements of the UDRP and come up with something a little more defined for clear-cut abuse, and we've taken that to heart, but we couldn't get that out to you today. We'll have that out within 24 hours.
Okay, thanks. No one else in that case? We can go to the format.
Yeah, David, it's Alan. One comment.
Oh, go ahead.
In listening to the call, the MP3 of the call for last week where I wasn't on, it strikes me that one of the things that I think Kathy was asking for is some examples of what is deemed to be clear cut.
Yes.
And somehow the conversation last week got derailed. But I think that, I mean, the one that has been mentioned is a clear use of what seems to be a trademark pointing to a monetization page. But if there are other examples that the BC or IPC can come up with, just as examples of what they think are clear-cut cases, it may be easier to put words around it to describe them.
Okay. Kathy, do you have your hand up?
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to lower it, but I think Alan makes a good point, and having more specific examples would be great.
Okay. And moving along, the format of the complaint.
Dave, it's Margie. Can you repeat that? Sorry, we were trying to take notes and got behind.
Do you want Alan to repeat?
Yeah, whatever the last point was, so I can make sure I've got it covered in the notes.
The point was, in trying to get words to describe what... a clear and obvious complaint is like, to try to put words around it, a number of examples might be useful. We've had one which is a clear use of a trademark pointing to a monetization page. if there are other ones that the BC and IPC can use as examples, not to restrict it, but to use as examples, it might be helpful in for the rest of us trying to put words around, you know, to describe what these, to capture what this really is. It's, you know, there are cases which apparently are obvious, but I haven't seen a lot of actual examples, and that just might help someone trying to describe them.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, then the next heading is the format of the complaint. Simple and as formulaic as possible with limits on length of complaint and answer. Any comments on that?
It's Alan. My only caveat on that was, yes, but it shouldn't be so short as to not allow someone to give a moderate explanation. I'm not talking about pages, but a few lines. In any case, not just tick boxes and room for four words.
Okay.
Do we want to describe the staff comments at the same time as we're going through this?
Good idea.
Yeah. This is Amy. It's David, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. What Alan just said is similar to what staff had indicated, that it shouldn't be a checkbox, that there should be some limited ability to put indications of your evidence, et cetera, in there without being a checkbox, and it should be some kind of a balance there.
Okay. I see two hands up, Kathy and Alan. Yeah, Kathy, do you want to go
I'm
ahead?
I'm sorry, I forgot to take it down. I will go back and do that.
Alan?
Okay, if we are now adding in our comments on the staff one, I, in fact, answered no, that the staff says it is not a checkbox, and I would say it is not solely a checkbox. I think checkboxes are good ways of identifying, a number of the answers. And the IRT one, in fact, had checkboxes and I believe placed to add some description after that. So I think the combination may be the appropriate one.
Okay. I think we can move along then to the...
Oh, I'll agree to that.
Okay, good. The standard for evaluation, no genuine issue of material fact, similar to Rule 56 of the U.S. Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and we seem to have a consensus, I believe, that notices by email, fax, and hard copy. Anyone, any comments on this? Okay. We'll move along then. Notice of contents, or the contents, rather, of the notice, it should be clear to the registrant, staff to evaluate options to implement, including language issues, in an efficient manner without requiring changes to who is. Let's see, the next, on passing initial examination, that's a different topic, I'm sorry. So that the clarity of notice, I think that's pretty clear. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I understand the desire not to change who is, but at the same time, I'm trying to understand how one could implement this without a change somewhere. If essentially we're saying that within some reasonable list of languages, we should be able to send the notice in the language of the registrant's choice, if it's not in who is, and if I remember correctly, this is a thick who is, it needs to be somewhere in a registrar database, which would have to be somehow queryable. Otherwise, how do we know what language the registrant wants to use? So although I'm not looking to make this more complex, but we do have a problem that I don't think that's recorded anywhere at this point.
I think you're right. Wendy, do you want to talk about that?
I'm sorry, I was just trying to call the attention of the person who's taking the notes in the bottom frame that, as I noted in the chat window, I just wanted to make sure the standard for evaluation consensus got into the summarized notes.
So we didn't. This is Liz. I'm taking the notes. That wasn't actually discussed just now. Is that the right? There is consensus on the.
It was discussed in with mode of notice, and nobody objected to either of those.
Yeah, so. I think we have a consensus there.
I thought I saw some comments on that somewhere on maybe from Jeff Newman. He's not on the call yet.
No, I'm on.
Okay.
What was the comments on what?
The question of the standard for evaluation, no genuine issue of material fact, similar to Rule 56.
Yeah, then Wendy had responded to that, and Wendy talked about an issue of no contestable issue. And then my comment on top of that was just to make sure it's not just an allegation that there's a contestable issue, but there's some credible evidence to support the contestable issue.
And Wendy, here, and that fits with my understanding of the summary judgment standard, that it's not enough simply to make an allegation, but to point to some evidence of the facts that back your allegation. And with that, it should get bumped over to a fuller proceeding in UDRP.
This is Amy. May I get in the queue, David?
Sure, go ahead.
So one question on that, you know, obviously speaking from a United States vision here, if you have evidence can be a declaration signed under penalty of perjury, is that what you guys are envisioning, Jeff, Wendy? Because a declaration is evidence. It's a statement, but it's under penalty of perjury.
Wendy here.
Oh.
That would serve my purposes.
Yeah, I'm a little. I'm not as convinced as Wendy is on that one. I think I'm not sure if a statement. I don't know what penalty of perjury means to people in other jurisdictions around the world, and I don't know how enforceable that is. So. I would think that it would have to be something external that they would have to point to, something other than a statement by the registrant that there's got to be some kind of credible other evidence, in my opinion, just because I don't know how you judge penalty of perjury in other countries.
Yeah, and I, Jeff, too, that was a question as well, because I don't know what enforceability it would have as well here in this circumstance.
Mark?
I was going to say that on this point about how much evidence is needed, the standard in the U.S. says it needs to be more than a scintilla. I want to throw that word in. But it also has to be genuine and material. And it in the U.S. on a summary judgment, it could be a declaration, but the declaration has to be probative, so it can't be solely conclusory. I mean, the finder of fact makes a judgment about the probative value of the declaration. And I would suggest that that same standard would be appropriate here.
Kathy?
I agree that going farther than just the statement and the perjury is important, and using the federal rules as a guideline. I think we're doing exactly what the IRT urged us to do, which is to go beyond to make the standard higher. So I support the no genuine issue of material fact based on the presentation of evidence by the complainant.
Okay. Any other comments on that?
So, David, it's Liz. Do we have consensus on that standard?
Well, I think we do. I think there's going to be some difficulty perhaps in expressing it, but I don't sense that there's any real disagreement on this. Zahid?
Thank you. Let me know if you can if there's any trouble hearing me because I'm using Skype from Egypt. What Mark has suggested is good language, and I'm just, although this is U.S. law and on precedents that make them out of U.S. law, etc., maybe it's necessary to also give explanations or put in language if there are dispute resolution providers or panelists. They would stick to those concepts. Maybe we could put this language in. Of
citizen language
you put into the draft.
Okay. Any other comments? Well, then I think we can go back to the notice contents. Alan raised a very interesting question of how you do a notice when you don't know the language spoken by the registrant without some new procedure in the registration process. I really see some difficulty there. Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, I had wanted to respond to that because I think ALAC has been, and Alan and Olivia have been great in pursuing the issue of language, and that's going to be critical. One thing that may give us a sense of the registrant's choice of language is what script they've registered the domain name with. Once we start dealing with the IDNs and GTLDs and various scripts, that's going to give us a real good indication. So if they've registered in ASCII, perhaps by default we can go with English. But if they've registered in French or if they've registered in Chinese, I think we have the registrant's choice. And let me suggest that I'm not sure the translation. I'm looking at staff comments, and I understand the idea of time and expense. But if we're talking about a notice, and so to do the translation, I mean, the vast majority of the notice is going to be exactly the same. A URS complaint has been filed against you, and really what you're doing is inserting the domain name and the dates. So if we pre-translated, it doesn't seem to me there's that much expense in pre-translating a set of notices into Chinese and Spanish and a number of, 10 basic languages, for example. And that will be what goes out based on the registrant's choice of language.
Yeah, of course, we have the problem of Arabic script. It could be Farsi, it could be Arabic, it could be Urdu. Margie, do you want to speak?
I wanted to comment because John wasn't able to be on the call, and I think that his point here was that he really didn't want to have something that changed who is. In other words, that you didn't have to add an additional field or do some sort of change like that. Perhaps there's a way to look at it, if they're using an English language registrar, for example, then it's probably appropriate to have it be English. In other words, it could be an implementation detail to figure out how to identify the appropriate language in a way other than tagging it through who is and requiring some sort of who is changes.
Alan?
Living in a place where French and English is spoken but not by everyone, Roman characters does not define the language. I can give more graphic examples, but leave it at that. You cannot assume that if you use Roman characters, English is an acceptable language for this. That's number one. Number two, I haven't thought about it at all, but maybe there's an opportunity to add some characters to some existing who is field to indicate the language. That is, it's not explicitly a language field, but if all registrars, all registrars and the registry supports that character string at the end or at the beginning of some field, it might be sufficient like that.
Okay,
I don't think you can get away without doing something.
Mark,
I wonder at this point if a simple approach is to have it be in the language of the application.
We still have to record that somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, this is Jeff. I don't understand how to implement the language of the application. You have to understand that when registrars submit data to registries, the registry doesn't know what language that's in. It just looks to see whether the characters are acceptable in a domain name string. There's no recognition of language. It's merely data that's populating our databases. So it's not something the registry could do. That said, it's EPP, which means we can add extra fields, which means that there could be a blank form or something that a registrar could fill in or a registrant could fill in that can be communicated from a registrar to the registry that indicates the language. I mean, one of the benefits of EPP is that it's extensible, meaning you could increase the number of fields with relative ease. But there is no recognition that could recognize or any kind of software at the registry level that could recognize what language the, quote, application is in. It's not a concept the registry understands.
Okay. Margie?
Yeah, I had a suggestion just to see if this is possibly a simpler way to look at it. As part of your evidence, you're attaching copies of websites, and that's in an English language or some other language. Is that an appropriate mechanism to use for the language? Because obviously, if it's in a foreign language, Arabic or whatever, you're going to have to translate it in any event to be able to to do your complaint. On the other hand, if it's English, the operator of that website, obviously, it's comfortable with English.
Okay, Alan.
I think this is an implementation issue. If we all agree that it is mandatory that language be a major focus of this, a way needs to be found. I don't think we need to engineer it here.
Yeah,
I would like to not see no changes to who is in our straw man, because it may well imply, as Jeff said, a change to who is a new field. It may imply a formatting of an existing who is field, and as Jeff points out, it's not the registry that can do this. It has to be at the registration time, with the registrar. But I don't think we need to engineer it, as long as we have unanimous consensus that it is something that is mandatory if we're trying to work and build a worldwide system.
Amy.
Yeah. Thanks, David. I completely agree with what Alan said, and just, you know, for pieces of information, with respect to the language, for example, as the UDRP indicates, that it is language that's the same as the registration agreement unless otherwise agreed or unless the panelist determines otherwise.
And Wendy.
I agree with Alan that this sounds like implementation. If we can agree that it's critical that the registrant get notice in a language that they can understand, and then try to figure out down the line how that will work.
Okay. I think we're ready to move along then. The next question is the effect of filing the complaint. The straw man, upon passing initial examination, there's an initial freeze, no transfers allowed, no whois changes, but the domain name will still resolve, and other features would function, such as email. Any comments on that?
It's Alan. I have a comment that's not quite on that, but in the IRT, there's a comment that the website is not allowed to be changed, which I don't think it's something that we can technically enforce. So should we choose to end up padding the words anymore, we should make sure that whatever we put is something that's enforceable.
Okay. I don't see any other hands up, so let's move along. Oh, Kathy.
Just that this write-up makes sense, as I understood the consensus of the group, so.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense. It's frozen. It can't go anyplace else. The domain name's frozen, but it's still in use. And from a registered point of view, that's critical, that nothing be taken down until there's an evaluation.
Yeah. Okay, then the time to answer, the straw man provides for 20 days with no fee required for the answer, as opposed to the initial staff. Mark, go ahead.
From the IPC's point of view, we're concerned about this additional time. I think Alan had a suggestion that might be a compromise that would work, or building on a suggestion, and that might be that you have up to 20 days to answer. If you don't answer within 14 days, the site is replaced with a notice, and then that a claim has been filed against you, and you have time to answer it. And if you do answer, the site goes back up. That, I think, could be a compromise that could meet the concerns about trying to get something that deals very quickly with problems where nobody's even going to bother to answer.
Okay. Any other comment on that?
This is Robin.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right in the queue. Yeah, the NCSG would have a big problem with the idea that a way of obtaining knowledge that you've got a complaint against you is by having the website removed altogether. That sort of is the harm that we're trying to prevent against in the first place, is having websites removed that don't belong to be, that shouldn't actually be removed. And so just, you know, to remove the website and say, well, now you know you've got a problem, you better deal with it, seems to me to be causing the problem and not addressing legitimate harms.
Okay. Constantinos.
Yes. I just think that we are still talking about these people that are not going to respond at all. And to me, this sounds like, you know, the presumption of guilt that we apply discriminately. And this is something that I feel in CSG. And the registrants that live somewhere off the beaten track in Africa and they're not online all the time cannot really come to grips with. 14 days, I understand the necessity for the 14 days, but at the same time, we need to give as much time as possible in a mechanism that promotes speed for the registrant to respond. So I don't see that 6 days is that much of a difference, to be honest with you.
Kathy?
Thank you. You've heard from the other members of NCSG. I'll just second what they said, and also that when we get to the appeals later on, I thought ICANN staff had some really interesting and insightful comments on this, on revisiting defaults. So, but I think sticking with 20 days is a minimum of where we need to be, and then speeding up the review, speeding up other things, so this becomes a really rapid review process.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I can certainly live with that. I was just trying to provide additional options. I will say that on rereading the IRT report, I found what looked like a conflict, and I'm not sure if it's just poor wording, in that if you read all the way to the end, it says that the website is taken down and replaced by a pointer to another page after a finding against or for the complainant. But it also talks about in the default answer that if a registrant finds his domain has been taken down, they may file a default answer, which implied that it was taken down at the 14 days. I'm not quite sure what the IRT implied or intended there, but some clarification offline might be useful.
Mark?
I'll just real quickly clarify that. The intent of that clause in the IRT report was to recognize that a default case might go to decision, and result in the site being taken down.
Okay.
But the only way in the IRT report that a site was taken down was after a decision.
Okay, thank you.
Right.
Okay. There are no other... Wendy, did you... No comment?
Just a quick question. Before we get too deep into the weeds of this removing a website, and I know it's mostly an implementation question, but I don't understand how it is implementable, given that there's no special marking in the DNS for website. There's no equivalent to DMX record. So how do you disable a website without disabling the other functions that a registrant may have used a domain name for?
Jeff or anyone from the IRT that could speak to that?
Yeah, I think the IRT, that was a problem in the IRT report. It's not one that some of us didn't notice it until after the report was out. It should not have said that... Wendy's right that if you take the name servers out or you point it to other name servers, you will not be able to use a website or email or any functionality. So there is no way to do one without the other. So is that the question, or did you want me to answer another question?
Right. The notice that would go up then would be what standard?
So I guess well, all the registry would do would be to point to a name server. The what we envisioned was that the name servers would be operated by the URS provider. So we would point to the URS provider, who would then put up a page with whatever standard notice you all think is appropriate, with a strict prohibition on the U.S. provider doing anything else with the traffic other than posting that site. In other words, it couldn't use the information it gets, the traffic, for any other purpose other than for putting up the notice.
Okay, so that it would be up to the URS provider to do that. Wendy?
That would be a condition of them being a URS provider. It would have to be a condition agreed to by the U.S. provider, presumably the ICANN, agreeing that it would only do certain things once the name servers were pointed to it.
Okay. Wendy?
I just want to point out that I think this raises additional issues like the ones that the SSAC has noted with wildcard redirection, that redirecting a domain name redirects all of its traffic, that gives the potential for interception or bouncing or of email and interference with all sorts of systems that may have nothing to do with the visible contents of a web page. So I would urge us to back away from this part of the proposal.
Alan?
I guess I take the opposite point of view, that one can imagine a URS filed not because of a website but because of the use of a domain name for phishing or something like that, and I would think it's imperative to disable the details to be worked out how, whether it's bouncing or whatever, but to disable email and other functionality as well. So I think we're taking the domain name down, which implies all of its functions.
Yeah, that's my understanding also. Jeff?
Yeah, so two things. Yes, when you repoint the name servers, you are taking down the ability of the registrant to use email or any other function. Second thing to Wendy. Wendy, this type of DNS redirection is completely different than a wildcard redirection and does not raise any of the concerns expressed by the SSAC in any of its findings. So we can go from a technical, we can have that technical discussion, but all of those concerns expressed by the SSAC actually do not apply here at all, because these are actually registered names. And frankly, redirection happens all the time in the real world, on a number of different levels. Registries do it all the time for fishing and farming when we want to cooperate with law enforcement or we want to collect data on an infected site. We often redirect to collect those statistics for actual beneficial purposes. That does not mean we should have the ability to collect that information and use it in some sort of commercial manner like you would an unregistered name. But so let's just be careful on what we say about the ESSAC study because it actually had nothing to do with this type of redirection.
All right, I'm happy to take this conversation offline. I don't think that we're so far apart, but I think that there are some concerns beyond what we've identified.
Okay. I think we can move along then. The next topic is the commencement of the evaluation. The straw man proposal evaluation commences immediately upon the expiration of 20 days and to be completed on an expedited basis. Examination, immediately upon expiration of 20 days. Jeff, did you want to speak to that?
No, sorry, I forgot to take my hand off. Sorry.
Okay. Mark.
I just wanted to comment that I think this very short window for the panelists to decide is actually a workable approach. We've got a couple of models for it. One actually is an ICANN model itself, which some people on the call may have been on the nominating committee before. I'm new to it, but there's a tool that the nominating committee uses where the information is posted on a site online, and when it's ready, the members of the committee can look at it that day and indicate and do a rating. Similarly, the American Arbitration Association, where I'm a member, has an online facility where this stuff gets posted and the arbitrator or the mediator would get a notice that it's available online and you can look at it that day and presumably make a decision that day. So I think this is a practical solution to getting a quick decision.
Okay, thank you. I think we can move along then to the number of panelists and the straw man proposal examination to be done by one panelist with a legal background on an expedited basis. Margie?
Yeah, I just had a question on the prior point. So where did we end up on that point? The expiration of the 20 days and the commencement evaluation to be completed on an expedited basis. I just want to make sure we've got the notes.
I think we had a consensus that the straw man proposal is workable.
And so I just note that it's Liz, that it sounded like the staff had a concern that the 3-day deadline might be difficult. I don't know if Kurt's on.
This is Kurt, so I'll get in after whatever David says I can get in.
Go ahead, Kurt.
Well, were you done, Liz?
Yeah, that was, otherwise I've captured it as support or I can put consensus for short turnaround, quick decision, but before I did that, I wanted to give you a chance to.
Okay, so we don't disagree with Mark that it's workable, but we think that, finding the panel provider will be balancing in order to ensure quality will be balancing several issues, and so a deviation from 3 days might be a more highly valued path if there are other considerations involved. So the staff comment is just that we'll pursue the 3 days with all due vigor and then, in a transparent way, do some balancing to determine who the provider is at the end of the day.
Okay. Mark.
Yeah, on this particular clause, from the IP's point of view, the trying to get a decision done within 3 days. We think it's practical, and we'd support that idea. We continue to be concerned about the 20 days.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I was just going to say that if indeed 3 days is impractical, because it takes a day and a half to simply, you know, nail down who the evaluator is, who the examiner is, then I would presume there's not going to be much discussion if it has to be 4 days instead of three, but we're talking about a short, measurable number of days and not 2 weeks or something like that.
No. Kathy?
Yeah, I just wanted to share that compared to where the UDRP is today with evaluations of, 25 days sometimes, this is going to be rapid review, but the closer to three business days, the better. But just also thinking of December, August, and language, there may be times that it may be four.
Okay. That brings us back to the number of panelists. One panelist with legal background on an extradited basis. Any comment on that? Kathy?
Not a comment on the number, a comment on the name. And it's something I circulated in an email, I think, earlier today, which is I'd like to suggest we change the name from panelist and panel to examiner. The reason why is I think we're going to wind up kind of talking about URS and UDRP, and to change the name, call it an examiner. In fact, that's the function. This is a fast examination. To call it an examiner will let us know immediately what proceeding we're in. So I just wanted to request a global change, if everyone agrees or doesn't oppose, to examiner.
Wasn't that the term used in the IRT?
All the better if it was.
I think I'm pretty sure it was.
No, I don't see any objection to that. Seems to me like a good idea. Okay, then let's move along to the assignment question. This is the one where Kathy and Mark did some work offline, and I read it very quickly. It seemed they were pretty close to consensus on that. Kathy, do you want to explain it?
Actually, can I recommend Mark explain it?
Or Mark?
Okay, sure. The idea was to create a process that would randomize panelists within a provider, and the purpose behind to leaving it within a provider is to encourage efficiency and competition between providers. Give the examiners the freedom to choose which providers they would work with. Some providers may not be efficient and may not pay or whatever, and people shouldn't be required. But the examiners themselves would be accredited, primarily based on experience and training. Perhaps there would be a training program set up for people to complete for this. This is a similar kind of thing to the kind of accreditation that other ADR services do, and that an accredited panelist, examiner, could but would not be required to serve on any or all of the panels. And so the random assignment of accredited panelists is the mechanism to avoid to achieve the fairness goal that Kathy has been speaking about.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions and some problems with what is proposed. First of all, for background, I'd like to know how it is different than what is done within the UDRP. But specifically, there's a statement made saying an examiner does not need to have to work for all providers because they may not pay. But I would think conversely, a provider may choose not to work with a given examiner because they have a track record of not delivering on time or a track record of, you know, reversals or something like that. And the other issue is I don't like the word random, because a random process is a mathematically defined one and is probably not applicable. You have to pick from people based on their availability, based on workload. Remember, if these are all five-minute judgments, you may have, in fact, have 10 at any given time, you know, on your docket. And I think we need to make sure that we're assigning them in a practical way so we really do get the answers out. So, I'd like to see quasi-random or something with some specifications of what we really mean by it.
Okay. Constantinos?
Yes. Alan, the way the UDRP works is that the complainant always initiates the complaint before one of the senders and gets to choose also the panelists. That, of course, has led, and that is the biggest concern, the whole idea behind forum shopping and how providers and panelists are assigned to decide the cases and how biased or unbiased they are for that matter. Randomization will ensure that this problem is eliminated to its possible extent. The fact that the complainant will not have any saying as to who is going to decide the case is very important, since we ensure the independence of the adjudicator to its certain possible extent.
I'm not arguing with that particular part. I was questioning, should a provider be required to work with all examiners who choose to, regardless of their track record or anything else?
Mark?
I just wanted to make a point of correction. Constantinos maybe went over a point real quickly that's not exactly right. That is, in the UDRP, when a complainant files a complaint and asks for a single provider, they pick the provider, but they do not pick the panelist. The only time a party gets to pick a panelist is if they request a three-panel decision, and in that case, both the complainant and the respondent get to pick a panelist. And the third one is appointed by the provider.
Yes, this is Constantinos. I am sorry, Mark, you are absolutely correct. The point that I was trying to make, I guess, was that once the complainant chooses the provider, there is anecdotal evidence that basically the provider will go for to assign the panelist that, you know, is in favor of the trademark owner or not. So, yes, Mark, you are correct. Apologies for that.
Okay. Kathy?
Alan, it sounds like, in general, you're agreeing with the approach that we're trying to prevent an outcome-oriented, a forum shopping just to get the outcome that you want. If it helps you to have the word rotation instead of random, that would be fine. There is a mathematical sense of the word randomized that can actually produce the same person at the top all the time, or can produce the same answer, depending on the algorithm. I don't think that's what we're going for. The idea is to rotate through all of the
Well, at large, certainly supports the concept of attempting to minimize or eliminate forum shopping. I was just worried about the wording used. Well, first of all, I was worried that a provider should have an ability to reject an examiner based on cause. And second of all, the use of random, I thought, was inappropriate. If you look at random numbers, occasionally you'll find 17 sevens in a row, and you may find a long string where there is never a zero. Random works in funny ways.
Yeah, I think we can move along.
Yeah.
Or don't want to beat this one to death. No, Mark?
No, I'll that's fine. We can pass it, move on.
Okay. The next issue is the evaluation on the merits. Unless withdrawn by the complainant, the panelists will evaluate the claim on the merits in every case, regardless if the registrant defaults or answers. The examiner will evaluate the claim on the merits. Is there any discussion of that? I think we have agreement, a consensus. That's pretty good. Moving along then to the remedy, if successful on the merits. The domain name suspended for the balance of the registration period and does not resolve to the original website. Reflects that the domain name is on hold and cannot be transferred. And as another question, option for the complainant to pay to extend the registration period for an additional year at the commercial rate. Comment on that. Jeff.
Yeah, just a question of clarification on the wording. The who is will reflect that the domain name is on hold, but the who is will not reflect that it can't be transferred. That's it's a true statement that if it's on hold, it can't be transferred. But I'm just saying that the wording there, the who is not going to reflect that it can't be transferred.
Okay, thank you, Zahid.
Thank you. Yes, my question is, what happens after that 1 year? I mean, does it go back into the pool and then can it be snapped up again? And just a general question. Are we solving a problem here? Just wondered if, you know, spark some discussion on that and get some responses.
Okay. Jeffrey Eckhouse.
Yeah. So I think my response to that is it's up to the person who has the name. If they want to renew the name again for another year, then it's their prerogative. If they want to let it drop, then that's up to them. I don't think there's been any discussion. I don't think anybody would want to say, okay, this name is being taken out of circulation. So they would become the registrant, so they would get to choose at that time, I guess, is the thought. I don't know if that's where we've been going, but I thought that was the thought of it.
Okay. Mark?
I was going to say that the option to extend it for another year, at least another year, is useful from the point of view that gives the successful complainant an opportunity to pursue the name in court or pursue the name through a UDRP. It also gives the registrant an opportunity to appeal as well without the name falling into somebody else's hands during that period. So it's a good addition to the proposal.
Okay. Kathy?
Just a question. I just wanted to double check that if a name is registered for a period of 10 years and this occurs, the URS occurs within the first few months, does that mean that this is that the name is completely inaccessible for the balance of the 10 years?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Margie.
Yes, I have clarification on what Jeff said. I didn't think that the who is record was going to change to reflect the complainant's name after a successful complaint, but maybe I misunderstood the proposal. I thought we were trying to separate this procedure from the UDRP so there would be a transfer of the domain name.
No, I think my comment was only that the who is will reflect the name is on hold. That's it. There's no change of ownership. There's no name change. All I said was that the who is on the domain name's on hold.
Okay, Zahid.
Thank you. So basically, if I'm a successful URS complainant, I get one extra year. I can renew it, and after that 1 year, but is there any other way I can purchase that domain name, or do I have to go to UDRP or court if I want to get that domain name and purchase it? Is there no way for me to purchase it through an auction or some other mechanism? Is there some other mechanism?
I want to just keep going on that thread. We just need to flesh this out. If the complainant decides, if he renews it for that additional year, then what is the status of the who is and the, I mean, you know, of the ownership and the who is during that 1 year extend, you know, during that time of that additional year? Is it, I don't know, I don't think we've discussed that on that point, on what happens to that, and is it, and is the registrar, is the hold lifted at that point? We have to discuss, I guess, the status of the domain in the additional year.
Jeff Newman.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a bunch of implementation issues we need to discuss, because technically if the name's on hold, then it can't be renewed. So there's no mechanism to actually allow it to be renewed. You'd have to lift the hold status. Everything would have to be done manually. I'm not sure how it's done. It's completely different than a UDRP, because in a UDRP, there's no hold that's put on the name. There's just a couple statuses that are changed, but there's no hold. And so these are statuses that don't currently exist in the registry. I am not in favor, I'll say it right now, of having the ability to have the complainant extend the registration of a registrant for any period of time, in the fact that I don't know how that's authenticated. I don't know how that's done. It's certainly a manual process. That's not something that can be done automated. And while it sounds like a good, from a policy perspective, I think that's going to result in some pretty major changes to the system. From my standpoint, I'd just rather have the name transferred immediately. From a registry standpoint, it's much easier for us to do. And I think we're creating we're trying to create a policy solution that's got a very difficult technological implementation. The other thing I would make a point of is that I'd like to make sure that once the name is released, that that registrars would not be allowed to take those names and auction them off in a back office, that they would not be allowed to take those names under their own wing and not be allowed to write contracts with their registrants, that if they were to lose a name in the URS, that they have the right to auction that off. I think that's pretty important, and we need to make that a definitive point.
Alan.
So I think what Jeff just said in his last point is that if a domain that has lost a URS expires, it must be deleted, as opposed to some other process. I don't have very strong feelings on whether it should be transferred immediately or we should tell the registries to write a whole pile of code to support what we're talking about right now. But I think it's important that we address the issue of a URS filed right near the end of a domain's life. One could imagine it expires even during the process of the 14 days, the 20 days notice, 3 days examination. And I think we definitely have to handle that case, whether we need to handle a full, adding a year when there's already 9 months left is a different issue, but we can't ignore the tail end case.
Wendy.
Wanted to raise the converse problem of we don't want to make this into a cheap way for one among many trademark claimants to get a relatively generic word that has been registered as a trademark by several. So the first one who files a URS gets it and then gets to register the name without going through whatever process the registry and registrars would otherwise have chosen to allocate what might be a valuable generic word.
Okay. Thank you.
So that would be my argument against the allowing someone to re-register after the URS has been implemented.
Zahid?
Yes, I'm very excited because one is that a successful registrant, should get one shot at it, and that's at no renewal. I'm also hearing that somebody said that you should at least just transfer. What I don't understand is how are we fixing the problem of the domain names going back into the pool? All it seems to me is that then the trademark holder or doing this every 1 year or every 2 years again and again and again. And I take the point that there are some names which could have several trademark holders who may have rights. But the converse is also true that this could be a name which basically is so well associated with one trademark holder that they just have to keep on doing this again and again. So how do we fix that problem?
Jeffrey Eckhouse.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what Jeff Newman said, was that there is a hold now, and unfortunately, it's something that the registrars do, and it is manual. And if the complainant, this is in a UDRP, wants to renew the name, then it is a manual process. We have to lift off the hold, renew the domain, and put it back on hold, all within a very short period of time. But it is done right now, and unfortunately, it is done manually at the registrar level.
Okay. Thank you. Mark?
Jeff has already made the point that I was going to make.
Jeff?
Yeah, but I think in this case, Jeff Eckhouse, this is being done at the registry level. The registry hold is different than a registrar hold. I think there's different implications of it. And what the URS is saying is that a registry hold needs to be put onto the names, not a registrar hold. The registry hold will make sure it's taken out of the DNS, and we'll all do all those things. But hey, if we're happy making the registrar primarily responsible for all URS, then I'd be happy to withdraw my comment. But I think we're talking about at the registry level. So if the registry has a hold now, there's no way for a registrar to come in and renew a name, to even delete a name, to do anything with the name. So we'd have to figure out some kind of implementation on how that would actually be done. And I'm not sure how that would be done if it was a third party, like a complainant, that was able to renew the name.
Kathy?
Question about procedures for expiration. Aren't there tools now when you know that a domain name is expiring and it looks like it's going to be dropped, where potential registrants can sign up and say, I want to pick that name up when it goes down? Are those tools good? Do they generally work?
Well, they're offered by many registrars or domainers as an option. Jeff Eckhouse?
Yeah, I'll respond to that. It's the way it works. I mean, it works as long as, you know, if you put the name you want in, and you need to put it in with all the different registrars that would go to auction that are going after that name once it drops, or you could try to do it manually if it's not a name that other interests would be in, but there's no centralized place that you say, I'm putting it here, and that it's going to be picked up by that entity. It could be one of many entities that picks up the name when it drops into the available pool.
Mm-hmm.
If it drops into the available pool.
Oh, no, it drops into if it's – unless the prior registrant comes in and gets it via RGP, then it's going to drop into the pool. Once it goes into the 5-day pending delete period, there's no getting it back. It's going to drop into the available pool.
Zahid.
Sorry, yes, I was just on mute. So here I'm thinking of a way to game this. If I'm a respondent and I lost the UDRP, I just don't appear, I don't do anything. The website goes down, and if this is a valuable enough domain name, and somebody files a UDRP, the successful URS complaint and files a UDRP, I suddenly file my respondent answer. So I basically am getting a second write, a complete de novo case being argued again. I hope I've made myself clear in what I'm trying to say.
Okay. There's nothing else on that. We can move along to the effect of filing answer after default. If a respondent fails to file an answer within 20 days and the examiner rules in favor of the complainant, the respondent can seek a de novo review by filing an answer at any time. If filed within 30 days of default, there's no fee. If it's after 30 days, there's a reasonable answer fee. In either case, filing an answer causes the domain name to resolve. The website will remain up. Any comments on this? Alan?
Yeah, just a clarification of if you said if the default answer is filed after the review, then essentially the process starts over again, factoring in the review with a new examination. I assume if the answer comes in partway through, somehow it restarts or it gets factored in, depending exactly on when it comes in. Yeah, we just have to address that gap, is all I'm saying.
Okay.
That is the period of time
yeah.
From the default until a decision is rendered.
Right. Okay. No other hands raised on that, so let's move along
So is that a comment, sorry, that I should capture? It's Liz. And is there consensus then on this and also on, I know, should I assume that there's not consensus on the preceding discussion?
I don't think we had a consensus on the preceding discussion, but I think there is consensus here that there may be some details to work out, but I don't see an issue that's simply a question of clarity in the way it's expressed. I think we can move along then to the appeal question. After a decision in a contested case, either party has a right to seek a de novo appeal for a reasonable fee to cover the cost of the appeal. In all cases, either party has the right to de novo review of the merits in the UDRP or a court. Any discussion on this?
Kathy.
Go ahead.
How would the registrant seek a de novo appeal on the UDRP?
Well, I think that if the registrant could go to court, but you're right. There is no registrant process in the UDRP.
Can someone
understand?
Can someone explain why we're using the term UDRP here?
No. The reason the question here is, what do you do when you've lost a case, and whether you're the registrant or the complainant? If you've lost, say if you're the complainant, you think that you used the URS because it was cheap and fast, but you've lost. So one of the things you can then do is go to the UDRP, or you can, if you're in a nation that recognizes the right, say in the United States, you could go to court and use the ACPA. Does that explain it?
I don't think that's what the wording says, but I understand that a complainant who loses can go to a UDRP. I echo Kathy's question that I thought this was addressing how either party can appeal, and in with reference to the next box, which is three-member panel.
Yeah, well, the language should be clarified, but I think the concept is clear enough. Margie?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. There's two cases covered. If it's a default, so there's a decision and then there's a default, you get the de novo appeal by filing your answer after default. So that's where it kicks in. If it's contested, in other words, it wasn't a default, someone answered and they lost the domain name, then they can go ahead and do a de novo appeal. So I think in both ways that there is a de novo. It's just different depending upon the path that you take.
Right. Mark?
I think the point I was going to make has been covered. It's Kathy's point, and you explained it, David, that the UDRP process doesn't have a way for a registrant to file a case.
Yeah.
Only a disgruntled complainant in this situation could go through that and say, okay, I want a UDRP case to be heard.
Yeah. Alan?
Yeah, if I take the description of appeal of decision and evaluation of appeal, for the complainant who loses, it seems like there are three paths. You can go to court, you can go to a UDRP, or you can request an appeal under the URS provision, which is what they're talking about, a three-member panel.
That's right.
For the complainant, for the registrant, they only have two of those options. It's go
That's
to court
correct.
Or file the appeal.
That's correct. Okay. So the evaluation of the appeal then is the three-member panel consisting of an expert in trademark law, fair use, and an academic in the field. And the note is this would be much more expensive to the appellant than the original staff concept of an ombudsman. Paul?
Yeah, my primary concern is I don't know who these people are. I mean, we can identify experts in trademark law fairly easily, and I suppose we could also identify an academic who maybe has a research agenda this year that includes trademark law and includes the domain name system, although academics do seem to go in and out of this area of interest. But I don't know who a fair use expert is. I've not been able to locate an association of fair use, you know, attorneys or anything like that. So my primary concern about this, you know, sort of in advance picking people from various pools, that not only are we defeating the wildly accepted idea of some rotation for panelists to ensure fairness, but we're also creating a category of lawyers that I don't know exists. Can someone speak to that?
Kathy.
Paul's right. There's no association that I know of free speech attorneys, of fair use attorneys. There are certainly associations of attorneys and others who work on fair use, freedom of expression, and those concepts, which are completely concepts of non-commercial use and fair use. And we can provide you the names of those associations if you'd like. But the idea here that you have, and there are certainly attorneys who are specializing in fair use, free speech, representing registrants, and the idea is to have a balanced panel. And I think there are ways to come up with wording on that, and maybe staff can work on it, but the concept of having kind of three diverse people makes sense to me.
Jeff.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned on that we're basically dictating the composition of the panel. There could be no issue of fair use or even a non-commercial academic issue in the entire case. It could be something that has nothing to do with those two, yet we're mandating that a specialist in fair use is on there. I think the concept is to have a panel of three so that there are more people that could hear it and make an informed decision. But I think dictating the panel is a mistake. And I just don't necessarily, I don't see why those other two categories in academic or fair use may even be relevant in a dispute. It may or may not.
Robin, can I get in the queue? This is Robin, can I get in the queue?
Yeah, first, Mark, I think, is ahead of you.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to agree with Jeff on the point that a three-member panel would be appropriate, taken from the accredited examiners that we've contemplated here, and not dictating to the provider or to the parties that these people will come to the table with any particular point of view, other than that they will be accredited to be part of this process.
Hey, Robin.
Yeah, the idea is really to try to get a balance of perspectives on the part of the decision makers here. When we say, you know, we want someone with intellectual property rights expertise, what does that generally in the real world mean? It tends to bring in those attorneys who have represented large intellectual property rights holders over the years, and that's the perspective that they hold in their mind when they adjudicate these claims. So the idea is we need a balance. We need the other side of that table to be represented as well on the panel. And, you know, we say a group of fair use attorneys. Well, for example, EFF is a group of fair use attorneys. There's a lot of academics that they work with that we could all come up with that have this kind of expertise such that it's not always on the side of the trademark holder, the particular expertise of the panelist. That's the concern that we want to build into the process, that there's more than just this one perspective that makes the decisions. And so that's why when we say a group of fair use attorneys, well, I mean, there actually really are in existence these kinds of associations. I mean, EFF is one example.
Yeah.
So I think we can find that kind of a balance, but we need to build it in.
Okay. I think it might be helpful, Robin, if you and your colleagues could circulate to the list of names of groups that you think would fill that function. Paul?
Just a question, too, about the difference between a fair use attorney and an academic. In my experience with academics, most of them have do not have the large trademark holder in mind when they conduct their research agendas and draft their papers. And I'm wondering, has any real thought been given to the inclusion of an academic? And if so, you know, what kind of criteria for the academic?
Okay, Jeff.
Yeah, I think I understand where you're coming from, Robin, but I think at some point they have a commitment to act in a neutral manner, and if they're not acting in a neutral manner, then that's a problem with the panelists or whatever we're calling them now. The point is that, and I agree with Paul, most academics that I know are more sympathized with, you can make the easy generalization that academics are more sympathetic towards fair use. Just like you make the argument that most trademark lawyers represent large corporations. I think both stereotypes are completely wrong. But we'll try to get away from that. I guess the point is that, look, anytime I go into an arbitration, I would love to have, you know, if I were to ever fight ICANN in an arbitration, I'd love to have a registry on the panel. But you know what? That just doesn't happen in the real world. I think what we need to do is make sure that there's training that happens for the panelists, that we make sure that we get panelists that are able to act in a neutral manner. And that's the check on the system. It's not ensuring that one person comes from this community, one comes from another, because then already you're biasing the determination.
Mark?
I'd suggest we look to the larger ADR world as to how these things are resolved, and this was adopted in the UDRP too, which is that if the parties choose a three-member panel, each picks one, and then the provider picks the third. Then you have a panel that has the necessary points of view from the different sides and is part of the accredited body of examiners without pre-designating outlooks.
Okay. Wendy?
I think I like Mark's suggestion, and I think the challenge of just picking three from among the panelists accredited by a provider would be that we'd replicate the biases that they came in with, and if we find that lots of these appeals are necessary because lots of panelists have come in with biases that are too far toward the complainant or too far toward the respondent, we need a way to correct for that. And so I like the arbitration, ADR style, let the parties make their choices or the outside experts better than I just take them from within.
Yeah. Amy.
Yeah, I just wanted to reset because I'm still a little confused in terms of the availability of an appeal in terms of what this group is talking about. I just got a little lost. Now, does either party get to appeal? Do we have consensus that appeal should be available? Or wasn't it the complainant, if a complainant lost, then they'd have to go to UDRP and or court if the court option
no,
is available?
I think it's very clear that we're talking about a separate appeal process within this system. This is outside the UDRP or court. I don't think there's any question about that.
So complainants who have lost can also appeal their loss.
Well, either loser, whoever the loser may be, can appeal if they choose to. And there will be a separate appellate system. That's what we're talking about now.
And then in terms of a fee, how will that be set by some appellate provider?
That remains to be worked out, but there will be some charge.
Okay, so I'm just because there is no appeal in UDRP, and I'm just trying to understand the
difference
here.
And why this is a different process. This is not the UDRP. It's different.
Yeah, but I understand that, but I'm just wondering what's the rationale for having it here?
Well, because the thought was that for a very fast process, the expedited process, there are an increased possibility of errors creeping in, and I think we have a consensus that an appellate process within the URS makes sense. I think you're raising a question that's already been decided.
Okay.
It's one of the areas where we do have a pretty good consensus. Kathy.
Some great ideas of being discussed here. Let me put them together in a slightly different way. Mark, I really like that idea of each side choosing their panelists. I'm thinking here that we have a fast process going on. So what about, and that process of picking takes time as well. So what about the concept of a standing review panel where, say, IPC has picked one of the panelists, and say where NCSG or NCSG and ALAC have picked another panelist as part of the standing review panel? Your idea that they both have to be certified or at least gone through the certification training is absolutely right. They should have the background in what is the URS and what is its purposes. For the third person, this is an idea I've been thinking about for a while. For academics, I mean, there are academics that have specialized in here. We could all imagine Michael Frumkin or Michael Geist coming into something like this. But also, it seems to me that there's a place here for registries and registrars, for you guys. Because, you know, provided you've gone through the certification training, that there's a place for people who are closely watching the real world and what are the abuses that are taking place and coming in with that real world view. So let me throw that out. A standing panel, certified, and with perhaps registries and registrars and academics as a possibility for a third panelist.
Alan?
Kathy suggested to address one of my concerns. If indeed there is the concept of an innocent registrant having a URS filed against them, the concept of someone who is not embedded in this process picking a panelist where they don't know of any panelists is problematic. So I think we need some sort of way of addressing that. We don't need to work out the mechanics today.
Yeah. Okay, we're now we're 2 minutes away from the top of the hour, and that means in 2 minutes our next call begins. We still have two topics that we have not reached, abuse of process and the review of the URS and UDRP. I think at this point, though, all we can do is wrap it up and we'll have to cover those in our next call, which I'm assuming will be next week. So I think in order to give everyone at least a very short break, we'll, Margie, go ahead. Margie?
Hi. I just wanted to check with Gisela. I think we might have to hang up and call back in. I don't know if we're allowed to stay on this call. Gisela, are you on the call still?
Yes, Margie, I'm on the call. If you could all please just dial in again and give the code STI. This will have two separate recordings and transcripts then. Thank you.
Okay. Well, in that case, thank you all, and I'll talk to you again in a couple of minutes.
David, is it possible to take a break? To call for like a 15-minute break?
Let's say 5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, David.
See you soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.